Mr. Chairman, members of the society, and guests. I understand that Court of King's Bench over in Great Britain used to have, and for all I know, it may still have, a department which was known as the Probate, Divorce, and Admiralty Division. A rather conglomerate and disparate description, as you can gather. And they tell a story that at one time, a judge who was fairly well versed in matrimonial and probate law, but had never dealt with the law of the sea and its various intricacies, was called upon to sit in that division in an admiralty case. And when it came time for him to render his opinion and judgment in the cause, he addressed the bar and he said that he was about to render his opinion and judgment in this case, and he said, "May there be no moaning of the bar when I put out to sea." I feel a little bit like that judge today, because as a practicing advocate at the trial bar and a county seat lawyer, in the tradition perhaps of Abraham Lincoln and Mr. Justice Jackson, even though, and I mean that, he wrote a very fine piece about the county seat lawyer, which I have framed and hung up in my office. In that tradition, I say, although lacking that eminence, I feel very considerable sympathy for that English judge as I rise here to speak to this distinguished assembly of scholars, intellectuals, and specialists in various disciplines. To be honest about it, I'm not entirely clear as to the intended theme of our panel, or as to the exact meaning to be attributed to its title. And I have concluded that I had best be governed by the advice of another country lawyer, Patrick Henry, who said on a famous occasion that I have but one lamp by which my feet are guided, and that is the lamp of experience. So I intend to speak out of my own experience, which is the thing I know best, and to express my own convictions derived from that experience, and molding or attempting to mold that experience and those convictions into some sort of a dichotomy with the topic, the rule of law and the role of law. I think I might say at the beginning that I tend to be what is nowadays called an economic and social conservative. At the same time, in many respects, I'm a Bill of Rights libertarian or even liberal. And I see no essential conflict in those positions, but rather an essential compatibility. Although I like to think that my liberalism, if that's the word in this field, is tempered by some realism and by some skepticism and by a modicum of common sense, I found myself quite frequently in agreement with my so-called liberal colleagues in the Congress of the United States when it came to the defense of the rights of individual citizens in the criminal courts. Where I differed with some of them was that I would extend those same rights to businessmen and even to a president of the United States, as they would to a Black Panther or an anti-war activist. And further, that I would extend those rights equally as against an allegedly benevolent socialistic government as against any other government. On the other hand, I found that I differed on some of these points with some of my good conservative colleagues with whom I generally agreed. As you can deduce from our discussion this morning, I have never been able to understand, for example, why a belief in capital punishment should be regarded as a good conservative position. Here, surely, it seems to me, the state assumes its greatest control over the individual, for it exercises the godlike power of life or death. And the state and the people who make up the state, being fallible and being arbitrary in nature, the result may be fatally mistaken, and the incidence of the penalty is almost certain to be capricious. Thomas Jefferson in substance said, in matters of power, let no more be said of the good intentions of man, but bind him down by the chains of the Constitution. And in considering our topic this afternoon, it seems to me that it may be well to recall to our minds briefly what some of these chains of the Constitution are. The provisions of our Bill of Rights, so dearly won and yet so familiar to us all, as to seem almost commonplace through being so familiar. The Fourth Amendment, with its provision that the right of the people to be secure in their persons, houses, papers, and effects against unreasonable searches and seizures shall not be violated. The Fifth Amendment, no person shall be held to answer for a capital or otherwise infamous crime unless on presentment of a grand jury, nor shall any person for the same offense be twice put in jeopardy, nor shall he be compelled in any criminal case to be a witness against himself, nor be deprived of life, liberty, or property without due process of law, nor shall private property be taken for public use without just compensation. The Sixth Amendment, in all criminal prosecutions, the accused shall enjoy the right to a speedy and public trial by an impartial jury, and to be informed of the nature and cause of the accusation against him, to have compulsory process for obtaining witnesses in his favor, and to have the assistance of counsel for his defense. And I think really it is not an overweening belief in the profession which led me to say this morning that the counsel for your defense makes a terrible amount of difference. In fact, it frightens me sometimes how much difference it does make in the actual result of a great many important trials. It's not that there are cases no lawyer can defend successfully. No lawyer is a miracle worker. There are things beyond what a man can do. There may be cases, although this is less certain, that no lawyer can lose. But there are a lot of cases in the middle where the man who is doing the work makes a great deal of difference in the result. And it's almost frightening sometimes, if you've seen it work, how much that difference can be. The Eighth Amendment, excessive bail shall not be required, nor excessive fines imposed, nor cruel and unusual punishments inflicted. Now we get there again into our discussion this morning about the death penalty because, of course, in Furman against Georgia, the court held, insofar as you can tell exactly what they did hold, because there really was no majority point of view. But the thrust of the case seems to be that the death penalty, as practiced in this country in the past, is, according to the court, unconstitutional as cruel and unusual punishment, as well as a denial of equal protection, basically because of its arbitrary and capricious, the arbitrary and capricious character in which it is imposed. I think I might say, in view of the discussion this morning, that although I am opposed to capital punishment and would not vote for it as a legislator, but I'm not convinced it's unconstitutional. That is a mistake we frequently make in this country, to think that anything we don't like has to be unconstitutional. And I'm not certain that that's true. It seems to me that when you consider the conditions when the Constitution was written and the familiarity of the death penalty at that time and the fact that all the founding fathers knew it was a part of the common law system, that it's certainly debatable whether or not they regarded the death penalty, whether you believe in it or not, as cruel and unusual punishment within the meaning of the Eighth Amendment. But at any rate, since that decision, a great many of our state legislatures have been trying to circumvent it in one of two ways, either by trying to give statutory guides to juries or by making the penalty mandatory in certain types of cases. I think those experiments are of very doubtful wisdom, and of course they have to be paid, passed on yet by the court, and that will probably happen in the near future, so we don't know exactly what the answer is going to be. But at any rate, these Bill of Rights provisions, and the words in these Bill of Rights provisions are famous words. Each and all of them have their history, and although originally drawn as restrictions on the power of the federal government only, we know now that through the decisions of the Supreme Court and under the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment, they have been applied down the line, practically speaking, also to criminal prosecutions conducted by the several states. So I think it's fair to say that the phrase due process of law, which comes down from Magna Carta's law of the land, is the heart of that rule of law which we are considering here today. And I think I might remind you again that these familiar words really have meaning only through being asserted and insisted upon by some lawyer somewhere working for a client in the courts in a situation which is not theoretical, but which forms a very active and vital part of actual life as it is lived. It's been my privilege, and so far as I'm concerned, I know of no higher duty, to spend a fair amount of my own life in enforcing these rights or sustaining this rule of law through practice in the courts. Most of the occasions on which I have done this have been of a kind that the world will little note nor long remember. But most recently it became my lot to defend and enforce as best I could these same principles in a historic proceeding involving the President of the United States. As I assume most of you know, I happened to be a member of the Congress at a historical period, and I happened to find myself on the House Judiciary Committee when, for the second time in American history, that committee was called upon to seriously consider the possibility of the impeachment of a President of the United States. And I was a member of the minority of that committee, which voted no to the three charges of impeachment which the majority of the committee brought against President Nixon. I voted no, not because I was convinced that President Nixon was necessarily innocent of all of these charges, but because I was not convinced on the evidence before us at the time we voted that his guilt had been established, which is a very important distinction. The committee voted out three charges against the President. The first was obstruction of justice based upon the so-called Watergate cover-up. The second was an alleged abuse of executive power through the misuse of various government agencies, such as the FBI, the CIA, the IRS, the use of the plumbers unit, allegedly illegal electronic surveillance, failure to prevent various illegal activities by subordinate officers, and so on. The several different acts of misconduct which were alleged in this charge were entirely disparate and separate and unrelated one to another. And those of you who are lawyers will recognize that as a matter of pleading, it was a perfectly horrible charge. It should have been broken down into at least five different charges. You really couldn't vote intelligently on it. You might have thought he was guilty of one charge and not guilty of another, and really, If you were in that frame of mind, it would have been hard to tell how to vote on that article. And it wasn't a fair way to bring it, but that's what we did. And the third charge was refusal to obey the subpoenas of our committee. Now, to my mind, Article 3 was legally faulty, because while I believe we had a right to subpoena the presidential tapes in the course of our inquiry, the President insisted that we did not. He said he had a constitutional right based on a constitutional doctrine of executive privilege, to withhold. And we never tested that right in the courts. The special prosecuting attorney tested it, and he got the tapes. But our committee refused to do that. And I said at the time, and I still say, that absent a decision by the judicial branch as to which one of us was right about constitutional doctrine, you couldn't possibly have an impeachable offense. How are you going to impeach a man for insisting on what he regards as his constitutional rights when it's never been determined by any court that he maybe isn't correct in what he says is his constitutional right? So I couldn't see that at the time we voted we had any right to impeach him on that basis when he was asserting what he said he had a right to do and a thing which we had refused to challenge and refused to bring to court for determination. Article 2, as I say, was a measurable mess of different charges. You couldn't really decide how to vote on that article very well because you might have had different views about different parts of it. In my own case, I did not feel that the evidence at the time we voted in the committee really established the case as to any of them, and that was why I voted no on that charge at that time. The first article, the Watergate cover-up, charged an impeachable offense in reasonably apt language. And I voted no when we voted because, again, I didn't think at the time that we had the proof. There were a great many suspicious circumstances. At the time, the thing that came closest to implicating the president personally, and that's what you have to do here, to show that he had done something or that somebody had done something at his order and request, was the matter of this $75,000 payment to Howard Hunt on the night of March 21st, 1973. We did have a tape which showed that they had a conversation down at the White House on that date in which they discussed that payment, Dean and the President and some others. And the President did say several times during that conversation that it looked like they'd have to take care of Hunt for the time being because they had to gain that much time and keep the cap on the bottle. Although at the same time, he said, we can't be doing this down the road because we can't be blackmailed. It'll all come out. We'll look worse than we were and so on. So there was some dangerous language there. But actually, he never went quite so far as to say, go ahead and pay the money. And the thing was sort of left hanging, and they went on and talked about other things. And even Dean told the senators that the money matter was left hanging. And more important than that, although it indicated, I would say, a willingness of the president to perhaps do something he shouldn't have done, it fell short of any proof that he really had told him to do it. And more important than that, the evidence showed very clearly when you analyzed the record that this was the last payment of a long series of payments where there was no evidence that the president had any knowledge of them. And this payment had been set up and arranged before that conversation, in conversations between Dean and LaRue and Mr. Mitchell, and they'd agreed to make this payment to Mr. Hunt that night. And it was all in the works, and it would have gone through if they'd never talked to the president that day at all. So even there, while that was the closest thing, I felt that really, as far as establishing a case, we didn't have it. And you've got to remember that the House has got to prove these charges before the Senate. We're the prosecutors. And we've got to prove it by competent evidence, with the Chief Justice sitting there and ruling on it. And you can't do it by hearsay or suspicion or surmise. You've got to have a case you think you can take to court and win. But of course, after we voted, we got the tape of June 23rd, 1972, which we got through the Supreme Court's decision in Mr. Jaworski's case. And I well recognize that those tapes which we did not have might have important evidence. And I suggested to my colleagues on the committee that we ought to wait to our vote until we got that evidence. We hadn't got it. And we didn't necessarily have any right to it, but it was pretty certain that the special prosecutor would turn this stuff over to us and that we would see it. So I thought we ought to wait and see what we had, but the majority was not willing to do that. So you had to vote on what you had then. And I would vote the same way today on what we had then. But of course, that tape of June 23rd, 1972, which was a conversation between the President and Mr. Haldeman, showed without any question that then, which was only 6 days after the Watergate break-in, Haldeman in effect said to the President, they're getting pretty close to us on this break-in. The FBI is beginning to trace some of this money that was on these fellows to the National Committee. Dean and Mitchell and I have been talking it over, and we think the thing to do is to call the FBI off, in effect, he said this, by telling them it's a CIA case and they better lay off it. And we think it'll be easy to do that because the FBI halfway believes that already. And the President said, okay, I understand what you're saying, go ahead, do it. Well, all right, that establishes a case. And of course, it cut out the great prop under the President's case, which was that he didn't know anything about this until March 21st, 1973, months later. This is June 23rd, 1972, only 6 days after the event. And it absolutely destroyed the argument which had been used and which we had used that he didn't know anything until the following March, and that then he got rid of these people quite quickly after that time, that he certainly had some leeway to find out what was going on before he fired everybody and so on. So when you once got that tape, you had your case. And the only question then was a discretionary one, and that was, should you go ahead and impeach anyway? That's a fair question. I think the Congress could use some discretion. Here's the President of the United States. He's been popularly elected. It's a traumatic experience. Should you necessarily impeach, even if you have got technically a case? It's something you could debate. But I don't think you could debate it very much here, not so much for the original offense, which perhaps might have been overlooked if they had admitted it and said they were sorry about the situation. It wasn't the most heinous thing. But when the President, at least three times, publicly stated to the American people that he knew nothing about it, and that's proved to be completely false, I think then you have a situation where you really had to support the impeachment. So I would say that all in all, the Committee on the Judiciary, although there were plenty of places in which we fell short, and if I had time or anyone is interested, I could criticize many things the committee did. But all in all and overall, I believe we did follow the rule of law. When we consider some of the actions of the President, on the other hand, we depart from the rule and get over into what our chairman has said is sometimes and too often the role of law, because while it was essential to our system that the President be extended the benefit of the doubt under the rule of law in a situation which is certainly at least quasi-criminal in its nature, it certainly seems probable that under the guise of law, he and his lieutenants did do a number of things which, whether impeachable offenses or not, did amount to an arrogant abuse of executive power cloaked in the seemingly legitimate trappings of the law. And the electoral landslide which followed as a result of the Watergate, I think, was a rebuke of that type of conduct. And it's probably, in its unfortunate results in the kind of Congress which it elected, one of the main things for which Mr. Nixon genuinely ought to answer. I'm afraid my time may be running to close, and therefore I will try to close this up. But when you consider what the present Congress, for example, and the ones that I was a member of were bad enough, When you consider what the present Congress is doing under the role of law, you can see how law can be abused, and you can see the sorry results of the Watergate situation. For instance, while there may not have been legal commitments, I think it's certainly fair to say that the Vietnam Accords were executed at least in the expectation that continued economic and military aid would be forthcoming. And now that isn't the case. The trade bill, which we passed last year, has been very largely nullified by the so-called Jackson Amendment, which the Congress insisted on putting on it. Secretary Kissinger and the executive's efforts for peace in the Middle East are only minimally supported by the Congress, and less so, I would say, daily. In the matter of the aid to Cyprus, the efforts of the executive, cutting off aid to Turkey because of the Cyprus situation, the efforts of the executive have been completely undercut by Congress. Now, you can argue these cases one way or another, but I am telling you, the Congress of the United States, under our constitutional framework, is not charged with, nor is it capable of, conducting foreign affairs on the floor of the House in the afternoon debate. And if we don't put this ethnic group, pressure group, foreign policy kick that the Congress is on, we're going to be in serious trouble in this country, in my opinion. And when you add to these things the proliferation of the executive agencies, which some of us are going to hear about tonight, and the unrestrained spending, and the income transfer from the productive to the non-productive, in which we're now engaged, all under the role of law, I think you can see very clearly how what passes for law can be abused. And I think we can see clearly that those of us who stand on a different point of view on these social and economic subjects have got our work cut out for us from a long time to come. And I'm glad to be here and share these concerns with you, because I am one who operates not in the academic world, but out where the fighting is going on. And as a slightly more hopeful note, it's my belief that if people such as myself can go out and talk to the ordinary man with the ideas which may be generated here in the language which he understands, that there may be hope. For instance, the so-called ordinary man is getting pretty worried about what his Social Security is going to be worth. It makes him pretty mad that they're taking more and more of his earnings and transferring it over to some fellow who isn't working. He doesn't like it. He's probably more belligerent about that than you and I are, quite frequently. He can understand these things if they're put up to him. And he can understand even that a minimum wage isn't necessarily compassionate when it results in about 40 or 60% of unemployment in the teenage blacks in the country, for instance. Those things the ordinary fellow can understand if it's taken to him. And that, it seems to me, is what we've got to do. And it takes both the academic community and those of us who are less academic but have to go out on the hustings and into the courts to carry the message if it's going to be done. So I appreciate your asking me here to be listened to today, and I hope that in these somewhat random remarks I may have thrown forth a few controversial thoughts here and there which might lead at least to a little discussion. Thank you very much.